This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQBar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQBar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQBar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQBar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Warning: the following contains spoilers pertaining to the show and the subject matter discussed. Also, strong language and adult content may be included. Listener discretion is advised. Thank you. I'm so excited to be visiting this place.
I know! It was so nice of Angelo to invite us to see him at the Slipper Room.
And I'm also excited to see a burlesque show. Come to think of it, my first burlesque show.
Really? You've never seen a burlesque show until tonight?
Not unless you count what we saw last evening, no.
Oh wow, then you are in for a real treat. Get excited! We better hurry so we aren't late.
Sounds good to me. Lead on!
Hi everyone, and welcome to Stage Whisper. I'm your host, Hope Bird, and with me is my co-host, Andrew Cortez.
Today we are going to be discussing the legendary show, Gypsy.
So hurry and take your seats, it looks like the show is starting.
Hello everyone, and welcome into today's performance of Stage Whisper. Curtain up, light the lights, you've got nothing to hit but the heights. That's right folks, we are diving into the life and times of the legendary Gypsy Rose Lee as we discuss the groundbreaking show Gypsy.
For this episode, we are mainly going to be focusing on the most recent revival in 2008, but we of course can't see where we are without acknowledging our past. So, bringing in our tale, we have to go back, way back to the show's inception in 1959.
The show is loosely based on the 1957 memoirs of striptease artist Gypsy Rose Lee's. Gypsy Rose Lee. The character of Louise is based on herself. June is based on the actress June Havoc, and Rose is based on their mother, Rose Evangeline Havoc, or Thompson.
This great American musical is considered one of the crowning achievements of the mid-century. It helped progress the book musical into what we know it to be today. The show was a project of producer David Merrick and actress Ethel Merman.
Turning our attention to the 2008 production, the show was directed by Arthur Lorentz, the set was by James Yeomans, costumes by Martin Paklidenes, reproduction of choreography by Bonnie Walker, lights by Howell Binkley, sound by Dan Moss Schreyer, hair by Paul Huntley, and makeup by Angelina Avalon. The music was by Jules Stile, lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, and the book was by Arthur Lorentz. The original direction and choreography was by Jerome Robbins. Irving Berlin and Cole Porter both declined Jerome Robbins' offer to compose the show. When Robbins asked Sondheim to compose after a successful relationship with West Side Story, he agreed. Merman did not want an unknown composer to write the show and requested Jules Stein to write the music. At first, Sondheim refused to only write lyrics, but was persuaded by Oscar Hammerstein II to accept the job.
The original cast album with Merman was Ethel Merman's first recordings with the then-new stereophonic sound technology.
Gypsy was adapted as a TV movie in 1993 with Bette Midler playing Rose. Midler won a Golden Globe for Best Performance by an Actress in a Miniseries or Motion Picture Made for TV. For its time, it was a rare example of a TV project being sung live and not lip-synced over a pre-recorded track.
The original production opened on Broadway on May 21, 1959 at the Broadway Theater. It then moved to the Imperial Theater in 1960, closing on March 25, 1961. It originally ran on Broadway for 702 performances. Since then, it has been revived four times. The latest revival opened on March 27, 2008 at the same St. James Theater and ran for 322 performances, closing on January 11, 2009.
The 2008 production was nominated for 7 Tony Awards and won for Best Featured Actress, Lauren Benatti, Best Featured Actor, Boyd Gaines, and finally, Best Actress, Patti LuPone.
The 1959 and 2003 cast albums each won a Grammy for Best Original Cast Show Album.
So, we've set the stage, now let's storm the floorboards.
We start the show at an audition for a children's vaudeville show put on by Uncle Jaco. Here we see Baby June and her sister Louise perform their kitty act. May we entertain you. June is an extroverted, talented child star, and Louise is the slightly older, shy one.
We are introduced to the girl's mother, Rose, as she interrupts their performance to remind Louise to sing out. Rose is the archetype of a stage mother. She is aggressive, domineering, and is always pushing her children to perform.
They sing their song over and over again at different shows on the circuit, with June always as the centerpiece and Louise often as one of the many backup dancer boys. Rose has big dreams for the girls, but encounters many setbacks, such as attempting to borrow money from her father, but to no success.
When Rose meets a former agent, Herbie, she persuades him to become their manager using her seductive and feminine wiles. The girls grow up, and June is now billed as Dainty June, and her act has the chance to audition for Mr. Goldstone of the Orpheum Circuit.
Meanwhile, Louise celebrates her birthday alone and asks her birthday present, a baby lamb, just how old she is that year. After Rose rejects Herbie's marriage proposal, he considers leaving, but she asserts that he could never really get away from her.
Now billed as Dainty June and her farm boys, the act finally performs on the Orpheum circuit. June is soon offered a place at a performing arts school after the audition. However, Rose turns this down, refusing to break up the act.
Louise and June fantasize what life would be like if Rose were married and finished with show business. A few months later, still on the road from show to show, Tulsa, one of the boys from the act, confides in Louise that he has been working on his own act. Louise fantasizes that she and he could do the act together.
Shortly after, June is missing, and in a note, she explains that she has grown sick of her mother and the endless tour and has eloped with Tulsa, and they will do a new act. Rose is hurt, but then optimistically vows that she will make Louise a star, proclaiming that everything's coming up roses.
Louise is now a young woman, and Rose has built a pale imitation of the Dainty June act for her. Using all girls, Rose and Herbie try valiantly to sell Madame Rose's Toradorables to a fading vaudeville industry.
Louise tells Mama that she's sorry she's not June. Rose, Herbie, and Louise sing about how they might not have a lot, but they are still together.
With no vaudeville venues left, Louise and her second-rate act wind up accidentally booked at a burlesque house in Wichita, Kansas, as a means to deter the police raids.
Rose is anguished as she sees what a booking in burlesque means to her dreams of success, but Louise persuades her that 2 weeks' pay for the new act is better than unemployment.
As they are introduced to Louise, three of the strippers on the bill advise her on what it takes to be a successful stripper. A gimmick, something that makes your strip special.
Backstage, Rose proposes marriage to Herbie. He asks her to break up the act and let Louise have a normal life. She reluctantly accepts, agreeing to marry the day after their show closes.
On the last day of the booking, the star stripper in the burlesque show is arrested for solicitation. Desperate, Rose cannot resist the urge to give Louise another nudge towards stardom, and she volunteers Louise to do the striptease as a last-minute replacement.
Louise is sad at what she's being pushed to do for her mother's love, and Herbie is disgusted at how low Rose has stooped, and he finally walks out on her.
Although reluctant, Louise goes on, assured by her by Rose that she needn't actually strip, but simply walk elegantly and tease by dropping a single shoulder strap.
Shy and hesitant, she sings a titillating version of the old Kitty Axe song, "May We Entertain You." She removes only her glove, but she speaks directly to her audience, which becomes her gimmick.
Louise becomes secure, always following her mother's advice to make them beg for more, and then don't give it to them. The song becomes brasher and brassier, and more articles of clothing come off.
Ultimately, Louise becomes a major burlesque star and does not need her mother anymore. Rose and Louise, who has become the sophisticated gypsy Rose Lee, have a bitter argument.
Rose, feeling sad, useless, and bitter, reveals that the true motivation for all of her actions has been to live vicariously through her daughters, to chase stardom that she wanted for herself and not for her children. She realizes that she has driven away June, Herbie, and now possibly Louise.
She displays the talent that could have been under different circumstances as the name Rose flashes in neon lights. After her admission to Louise, mother and daughter tentatively move toward reconciliation in the end.
Depending on the production, the end has been altered to see a not-so-happy ending. Sometimes we see Louise walking away as Rose's name in lights slowly fades. In others, we see Rose stare longingly at the stage as the two leave.
The end. So let us now talk about the show. And again, reminding our listeners, we are mainly pertaining to the 2008 production, the Patti LuPone version. It's such a good show. It's one of those shows that I feel like a lot of people don't realize that they know or they are familiar with. But it's such a good show.
Well, and the thing that I really appreciate about the show is it's such a classic story that all of us are like, oh yeah, you know, I know that story. But really, this is where that classic story comes from, is Gypsy.
Exactly, with so many familiar songs as well. I remember when we were talking and we were going over the story, we actually watched the film to refresh our memory. But as we were talking, you were like, I don't think I remember this show. And I was like, no, trust me, you do. And then when we came back and we met to finalize our script, you said there were a lot more songs in the show than I thought I recognized than I thought I did. And I was like, oh yeah, no, this is one of those shows that cranked out hit after hit after hit. You know, in fact, as we just read the summary, I'm sitting there singing the songs, you know, If Mama Were Married, Everything's Coming Up Roses.
May We Entertain You even gets stuck in your head. And like, even just some of like the underscoring that happens, like that classic bum, 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 bum. That's Chicago. I just did that.
But well, I'm thinking, you know, of like Rose's Turn. Bum, 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 bum. All this then, where did it get me? I mean, it's iconic. It is one of those cornerstone shows that it just gets under your skin, into your veins, and it's an artery of the theater. Mm-hmm. You know, pertaining to the 2008 production, I want to start with the costumes. They were just this beautiful, classic, iconic look. Very perfect for the time. Very simple.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you didn't need a lot to... Well, I mean, of course, they didn't have a lot. I mean, you weren't going to get these ornate, you know, Follies-looking costumes.
Well, no, because it was 1920s, so we had, you know, or at least that's where the story starts, is in the 1920s. And by the time we get to the end, we are more in, you know, Great Depression era.
But seeing these simple looks, you know, Rose in this blue dress, Luis is in this, like, gray dress, Herbie's in that gray suit. In fact, that gray suit, I remember when we did Will Rogers Follies and seeing the character of Will Rogers in that gray suit for the Depression. That's exactly what Herbie wore. It looked exactly the same. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm just like, okay, yeah, they're just very simple. But to counter that, one thing I do remember was the strippers' costumes.
Mm-hmm.
There were lights in them. You know, I remember, like, there. This was 13 years ago. But I'm having these flashbacks to, like, Statue of Liberty, and there were lights on the brassiere and everything like that. But they were these fanciful, not ornate. They were just burlesque, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Pushing the envelope, obviously you knew what they were. Tawdry, tongue-in-cheek, in all the right ways. It was sexy for the theater without being sex, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, exactly. It was
raunchy for the theater.
Yes, for the time. But, like, it's that whole burlesque era.
But in this production, the way the strippers were dressed,
mm-hmm.
it was very... what's the word I'm looking for? Like, exaggerated raunch in a theater way.
Okay, I can get that.
Yeah, it wasn't the... Don't think about the girl with the pasties or in the balloon thing. Mm-hmm. They were meant... Like, you knew that they were strippers, but we were kind of exaggerating that burlesque look in a sense. But it only is going to make sense and read like that in a theater. If you were seeing this on film or anywhere else, you'd be like, this looks... almost cosplay. But because of the show, you know, because it was theater, it worked out perfectly. Because mm-hmm. of course we're not going to go see nudity. Like, this isn't going to be like that. We're not going to get down to where it's pasties and a well-placed G-string. That's not what we're going to do. It was, and it almost had a hint of old Hollywood too, which was nice.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that. We've already mentioned the music and lyrics. You know, it's legendary, it's smart, it's one of a kind. I think the book goes with it. And I think the book needs to be mentioned. We've already mentioned that this is a show that really helped further the American musical with the sense of the book. You know, the book is just as important as the music, and it really helps push the story and all that. And it is. I mean, this is a show where we got a lot of plot and story and everything in just the book, and then we had the song that kept the story going and mm-hmm. not just stop to hear a song and then we pick up in the book. Everything just kept flowing forward. It was
and building.
Exactly. And there's just clever wordplay in there.
Well, and the thing I really appreciate about Sondheim's work, like, I mean, let me just get into it. Like, I think I love Sondheim as a composer, but I particularly love him the most as a lyricist because he is so witty with his lyrics.
See, I think his music and his lyrics mirror each other. If this doesn't make sense, fine, but I agree with you. I hear his words and his music in the same sense. Like, there's tongue-in-cheek in his wordplay and everything like that, and the same thing in his music.
Yes.
And I think that's the brilliance of Sondheim.
Which is why, I mean, you know, this show is great as is, but I just wonder what it would have been had Ethel Merman not been like, I don't want to, you know, an unknown composer. Like, because, I mean, listen, it's not that I don't like Jill Stein. Like, his work is also great.
That would be interesting, but I think Jewel Stein and Stephen Sondheim worked out so well.
They did, but that's...
Well, hold on. I think it worked so well for the time. I worry that if it had just been Sondheim, this may not have been as successful as it was, because it may not have had the audience or the love or the lore, or all the parts may not have come together.
Because it did need that nostalgia quality that Sondheim wasn't really necessarily working with in his own composing at the time.
This was still on the edge of the golden era. It's still a golden era musical.
Yes.
So it's still there. We haven't broken into the modern musical. We haven't passed Fiddler on the Roof. We haven't hit Hair. And Sondheim is definitely a modern composer. I think this benefited him, but I think you can hear the influence of Sondheim and his lyrics in the music. I'm thinking about the syncopations and like everything's coming up roses, you know. Everything's coming up roses and daffodils, da 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 bum, bum.
But then
bum,
you
bum,
have
bum,
to
bum.
Ask yourself, because we weren't in the room where it happened.
Terrible.
But you know. Was the music influenced by the lyrics, or were the lyrics influenced by the music?
Well, to me, in my opinion, because of course we weren't there, but I think that's synergy.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I will say that I think Stephen Sondheim is a pro at, considering who his mentor was, Oscar Hammerstein II, is he knew and recognized synergy.
Mm-hmm.
And he understood that the lyrics and the music must feed off and into each other. There's a reason why Rodgers and Hammerstein shows are so infectious and so successful, you mm-hmm. know, because everything works and flows together. And I think that's the brilliance of Sondheim. And if you ever look at a Sondheim score, holy hell, it's complicated. Into the Woods, Sweeney Todd.
Sunday in the Park with George.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. But that being said, the music and the lyrics, I mean, they go together. One thing leads to another. And when you don't look at it on such a minute scale, when you pull back a little, you know, when you're not Georges Bizet doing pointillism, bum, 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 mm-hmm. you know, one spot at a time, when you're actually looking at the picture as a whole,
mm-hmm.
oh, okay, it all clicks in. And I think that's the beauty and the brilliance of Jules Stein and Stephen Sondheim, is it gels all together. And then you bring in Arthur Lorentz's brilliant book that sets up and leads mm-hmm. out of these great songs. There's a reason why this show is just such an epic work. There is no low point. You don't get let down at one moment or the other.
Yeah, there's
Everything leads to the next. And there's always a gimmick, and there's always a wink and a nod, or there's something else to mm-hmm. lead each scene. I mean, I'm thinking right now, one of the things I loved is when they go to the Chinese restaurant and she steals the silverware.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, there's no rhyme or reason why she steals the silverware, but she does it because it's compulsive. That's what she's always done, even though she's not in a place that she needs to do it. But she doesn't. And it's like, that's the brilliant... Arthur Lorentz was full... He fully realized that world.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing that wasn't... That he didn't see. He took into account everything. And I think that's why it was so solid. Is he could... He mm-hmm. was evaluating everything that every character was seeing and feeling. And in the past, before the show even started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, here's the question I'd like to pose just while we're on that subject, because this show was written because Ethel Merman wanted it to be done. You know what I mean? And so sometimes I just have to stop and think, like, would this show also have been as great of a success had she not been one of the producers and the lead?
Yes.
You think so?
Yes. I can tell you why. She might have wanted it to be written, but I still think it would have been written without her. I think she wanted it to be written as I think Arthur Lorentz and them were going to write it anyway. I think Merman just got on board as a producer and it to be, and I don't know, I'd have to do more research in this. We've told all of you before, if you want perfect facts, you need to go somewhere else. This is just our best intuition and some of the quick research
we do.
There's
too many shows to go that depth into it, but hey, that's why we have dramaturgy, right?
Our purpose here is to talk to you about our experience, but I believe this was supposed to be like a vehicle for Merman,
mm-hmm.
you know? But I'm going to tell you who would have stepped in if it wasn't Merman. Arthur Lorentz, Jules Stein, Stephen Sondheim would have still written the show. And maybe not Jules Stein. It might have just been Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
Could have, you know, but, and it would easily have been the woman who played Ethel Merman's understudy in Call Me Madam, Elaine Stritch.
You know, in my mind, I always forget Elaine Stritch as a younger performer. I always think of her in Company.
Right. Right.
Always.
And as an older woman, it's the little things you do together. In fact, I'm in the middle of reading her biography right now, which is really fascinating. Her and Merman, not so much getting along together. But she is such a character, and I could see her in this role. And actually, when I was at the gym, and I was reading this book, and I'm reading about her, how she's understudying Merman in Call Me Madam, I actually thought about that, where I went, I wonder what Elaine Stritch would have done had she been the original gypsy. Like that, you know, if you could go back in time and recast it, like that could have been real interesting, because she was a hell of a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And even in her younger days, she gave it all. She was very not tempestuous, but she was brilliant and smart. And really talented, but she offstage she was a little bit much to handle. I mean, alcohol is a hell of a thing. But she was a brilliant artist, and nothing should be detracted from that.
Right. Well, and I will say another thing about this story that I just love is it brings out that Broadway diva. So whoever plays Rose has to be like that classic Broadway diva.
Well, she starts at a 10 and it has to go to a 20.
Exactly.
And that's why Patti LuPone was perfect. The energy has to start at a 10 and it has to go all the way up to a 20. We have to see that spiral, that madness. Because the show ends with this mental break with Rose's turn.
Mm-hmm. Because you can't keep slamming your head into a wall constantly without something breaking.
Well, right. And I mean, that's the thing is the show might end with like an exhale, you know, where they come to terms in some form or fashion. But we have this explosion in Rose's turn. And that's something that everyone loves to do because it's such a fun song, you know? Can't tell you how many people when I went to school did that song. But here's the thing. You have to commit 110%. If you give 109%, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. So if you're going to have to end on this, like, I'm lighting the curtains on fire and throwing the cats out the window and drowning the kids in the tub kind of thing, you have to start somewhere. And the show doesn't give that character a vehicle to accelerate from zero to that. So you have to already start doing 90 miles an hour to get to 110.
Mm-hmm. And it takes a very strong performer to maintain that and not make it... Like, because here's the thing about Rose is she is definitely that chaotic energy. And it is hard.
She's trying to control the world around her, but she has no control over herself.
Exactly. But that's that thing about people who have extreme chaotic energy is it can be overwhelming really fast. So we still have to fall in love with Rose enough to be able to keep watching. And so the fact that you have someone who has all this chaotic energy but can still make it lovable is just a stroke of brilliance that comes from, that, like we talked about, the synergy with the music, lyrics, and books, but then also to take the right performer to be able to be Rose.
Right. You have to love them for their faults, essentially. Not love them for their good intentions.
Exactly.
Because really, at the end of the day, there's no good intention behind it. She might say, I'm trying to make my daughter a star. No, she's trying to make her a star.
Right, she's, and she's falling
living vicariously through her children.
Because she was too afraid to go out there and do it herself.
And it's easier to push someone else than it is to do it yourself.
Yep.
Just two more things I want to mention about the design and whatnot. The sets and the props were amazing, especially when we were flipping from the show to the backstage, which was great. It was very simple, but it did the trick. Some footlights showed the stage, and then we flipped around. There were some crates and boxes. Now we're backstage. We had a table and a couple chairs to show the Chinese restaurant.
I was going to say, that's the nice thing about the majority of the show being taking place in a theater.
Well, and the impressive thing is that this show is in the St. James Theater, which is actually one of the larger theaters. But for all of you at home, fun fact, the St. James stage itself is actually not as big as you think it is.
Yeah.
We got to go on a backstage tour in another show with a friend of ours, which we'll talk about when we get to that show. But getting to see it, it was like, oh.
It's tiny.
Oh. I mean, it's wide, but it's not deep. So it's one of those like, oh, okay. But then also on the lights, they were balanced, they were beautiful, and the stage wasn't completely lit when it didn't need to be, which I think also helped with that. And I love the spot, the classic spotlight during Rose's striptease when she's having her mental break. You know, hi, my name's Rose, what's yours? And there's like this perfect spotlight on her so that she's not, I don't know, it's not the classic spot, you know, there's someone on stage and I have to light them. It's that burlesque spot.
It's kind of, this is going to sound crazy, but follow me on this. It's the insanity spotlight. It's the one that when it goes on, you can tell that you're living in a world between what's real and what's not.
Kind of. No, I was thinking more of like that classic vaudeville spot. Like the cabaret. Think about that spot that it doesn't light the performer from head to toe.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts with just her face, but then it goes to her face and waist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less about lighting the actor and more about creating an image.
Yes.
You know, as she spirals more into her delusion, her insanity, the rest of the lighting comes in. And I know what you're talking about. And it creates that, it literally creates like that foggy, like,
dream world. Like, yeah, we're in between reality and not.
That limbo where, like, we have no idea where we're at.
This show has seen some legendary cast members, including Miss Patti LuPone, Laura Benanti, Tony Yezbeck.
Other productions saw the likes of Ethel Merman, Bernadette Peters, Brooks Ashmanshanks, I can never say his last name, Michael McCormick, Tyne Daly, and Angela Lansbury.
Now, I know we've started trickling into it, but let's discuss the theatrical impact. I mean, we've already touched on it. Like, it's the progression of the book, and this is, you know, where we started to, you know, this is during when we really started to play with what we could do with storytelling. Like, did we have to have a linear story that was, you know, obviously how time was passing, or could we do kind of this weird montage, like, strangeness that you get in, you know, May We Entertain You, where the girls are getting older, but they're not getting older, if that makes any sense.
It created the modern American musical as we know it today, in regards to story and music. Like, before, I feel like the songs didn't necessarily push the story. There was a commentary, or it was a song to sing, or it was like a monologue.
Yeah, you kind of think back to like Ragtime.
Well, no, I wouldn't go to Ragtime.
Okay.
I'd go to Oklahoma.
Okay, yeah.
You know, sometimes it was just like, everything's up to date in Kansas City. That doesn't do anything to further the story, but he's telling us where he's been. I can't, I'm just a girl that can't say no. That's just telling us about her. That doesn't really further the show. There are songs in this show that actually further or give us more in-depth information that'll help push the story along. You know, if Mama were married, why do these girls want Mom to be married? Everything's coming up roses. That's the first break of Rose. Why is that significant? And then, of course, there was no dream ballet. A lot of these shows had big dance numbers. This one didn't have a big dance number like that.
Mm-mm.
And so if you think about the American musical, the modern American musicals we know it today, it kind of got its start here with Gypsy, where it's like you need a solid story. And from there, we're going to put songs that are going to help push it along. And when it doesn't work, when this idea doesn't work, I'm going to go out here and say something very controversial. That's when you get a jukebox musical that doesn't work. When people pick songs and then build a story around it versus picking the story and putting songs in. When you just want to hear music, but you don't want to hear a story. Nobody wants to go see a show that doesn't have a good story.
That's true.
You know, and so I think that's where Gypsy comes in. I also think it gave the theater iconic songs. And I think it's songs that we all, whether it be not just theater, but entertainment as a whole draws on. I can think of so many other shows that have ripped from that, you know, Simpsons, Family Guy, or what have you, Glee, everything like that. They've drawn from the music of this. In fact, I'm thinking of Something Rotten right now, actually. When he goes to the alley, bom, 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 yeah. Bom, it's the opening. I had a dream about you.
Right.
This music, this story, it's one of those like we look to. I think it's like a Phantom of the Opera or a Chorus Line. It's one of those story, those things in the theater that if we looked at a timeline, boom, there'd be a notch. Like, this is Gypsy.
This is, yeah.
It wouldn't be a footnote. So that's where I think it's left its huge theatrical impact. And that leads me into societal impact, you know? Like I said, the hit songs from it have been referenced all over cabaret, all over pop culture. I guarantee if you walked to any cabaret bar in New York, I'm sure someone's singing something from Gypsy.
Well, and this, the concept of the dance mom or the stage parent, like...
Oh, yeah.
I mean...
How many times Rose, have you seen someone been called a Gypsy Rose Lee? Stop being a Gypsy Rose Lee.
Which is funny because Gypsy Rose Lee is actually the Louise.
But, I mean, what they're getting at is... You know, the mom, which I find funny, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of like a lot of people think that, you know, Frankenstein is the creature. And it's like,
the doctor.
It's the doctor. Yeah. Yeah, it's that same thing. Like, they think Gypsy is the mom. And it's like, no, no, no.
Well, Rose is the mom. I think this story tells the story of a lesser known theater icon. Burlesque is theater. And if it weren't for this, we wouldn't really know who Gypsy Rose Lee or her mother was. You know, and I think that's important. I think burlesque and the arts of burlesque need to be told. There are stories that need to be told because, especially from this time period, I mean, have their art form demonized.
Well, and especially when you start getting people, you know, like Mae West maybe wasn't exactly burlesque, but she definitely was burlesque.
She dabbled in it.
Yeah, and just this whole idea that happened, you know, adjacent to the vaudeville scene was the burlesque scene where you had the, oh my gosh, what were they called? Obscenity laws.
Yes.
A lot of people don't know about the obscenity laws. And
which were just completely ridiculous, but...
Right, but to understand... Right, but to understand how the wheels in motion for where we eventually got with the Stonewall riots, like, reverse, like, clear back to starting during this, like, burlesque era.
Well, a lot of rights and a lot of things with the union come from the burlesque as well, mm-hmm. You know? And I also feel that this latest revival helped bring the Golden Era musical into the 21st century. And what's significant is it's still being helmed by one of the original creators in Arthur Lorenz. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that the Golden Era musical wasn't in the 21st century, but I feel like, and look, I could be naive and I can be wrong. And you know what? If I'm wrong, send us an email. I'll be wrong. That's fine. But I don't recall a Golden Era musical that everybody was like, oh my God. Now, it could be Patti LuPone. But, I mean, everybody knows Gypsy. You know what I mean? I mean, of course, we all know Oklahoma and all that, but everybody knows Gypsy. And for it to make such a huge return.
I mean, to be revived again and again and again and again.
To have this huge success off-Broadway at, I can't remember where it was done at first. I wanted it. It's not second stage. It's escaping me now, but to be done there and then to be brought to Broadway and just have such a great run. I mean, yeah. So, final question then. Is the show still relevant? I mean, absolutely.
I mean, this classic story of, you know, living vicarious through your children, that's a timeless story.
It couldn't be any more important than now, right?
Right.
It's legendary. It's a cash cow, a barn burner, a smash. It's popular with all audiences.
And if you don't know Gypsy and you haven't seen Gypsy, as soon as you see it, you become obsessed.
Absolutely. Sometimes we just need to see a classic story, a familiar story to escape with, you know? And And this is like one of those shows, like, you know, the great works of Shakespeare and whatnot, the actors like strive for. This is one of those shows that the great actors of in our mm-hmm. in theater want to play. And so it brings out the best talent. And I'm looking at it and I'm going, okay, so we've gotten Patti LuPone to play it. Okay, who's next in the lineup that's going to step up and play Herbie and Louise and Rose? Like, who's going to step up and play these roles? I'm excited to see who our next Rose is. Who is that person out there? Mm-hmm. In fact, listener, I would be interested. Comment on our Facebook or our Twitter or Instagram or send us an email. Who do you think would make the when they mount the next revival? Who do you think would make the best Rose?
Yeah,
because that would that's an interesting question. I'm gonna lead. Part of me wants to lead towards. I can see your face.
Stephanie J. Block.
I didn't even think of her.
Yeah. Stephanie J. Block for yeah, sure.
I was thinking of, what's her name? She played in The King and I.
Oh,
Kelly O'Hara.
Yes.
But Stephanie J. Block. Oh.
She has that character down.
Or Sutton Foster.
Sutton Foster. Sutton.
But I think Stephanie J. Block has more of that mom.
Yes.
To her.
Yes, I definitely agree.
I didn't even think of her.
You're welcome.
Oh, that would be... And so then who would play Louise?
Ooh. Ooh, that's a good question.
Courtney, I have no... No. love Courtney. Louise. A younger ingenue.
Well, part of me was thinking Laura Osines, but... not necessarily. She's too Disney princess.
The thing is I think the next Gypsy that they do. Okay, hold on. I'm gonna throw out something here. She's playing Persephone in Hadestown. Would be like a great Rose.
Yes.
Because the next Gypsy they're gonna do is gonna have POCs.
Yes.
Norm Lewis is gonna play Herbie.
You think so?
There it is. Tell us what you think out there. We want to hear from you. Like, this is fun. This is fun. I can't wait to see it. Christopher Jackson would make a really good...
Herbie.
You know, Philippa Sue could also be a good Louise.
You know, she could.
She would make a decent Louise, yeah. And Carrie Butler could also make a really good Rose.
Carrie Butler, though, I would like to see Carrie Butler as Dainty June.
I could just see Carrie Butler, like, read a catalog. Honestly.
I freaking love Carrie Butler. As promised, we wanted to share some of our own personal stories about experiencing the show.
So I had the privilege of seeing the show back in 2008.
And I talk a really mean game of seeing the show, but I've actually only ever seen the movie.
So this won't be a huge long one, but I got to see Patti LuPone, Laura Bonatti. It was amazing. But I will never forget, I saw a matinee performance of this, and I did not appreciate Gypsy for what it was when I saw it. Little 19-year-old me just did not have the brain to understand, first of all, what Gypsy was or the fact that I was seeing Patti LuPone. But I remember being at the matinee and sitting there, and an announcement came on. And said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to inform you, Miss Patti LuPone sprained her ankle earlier in a rehearsal." And you heard an entire theater just, because we thought, you know, she's not going to be on tonight today. And they went, "But she will still be going on, but she may not be performing all of the moves she is blocked to do." And everyone just erupted with laughter, like, "Yes, oh, praise the Lord," you know. And Patti LuPone was absolutely phenomenal. absolutely phenomenal.
You know what we haven't talked about? Speaking of Patti LuPone being phenomenal in this role.
Oh, wait, hold on. I'm getting there.
Okay.
So, after the show, I did the kiss and cry line. Laura Benanti, Patti LuPone, signing autographs. And someone did do the clap back, the call back to her famous line when she won the Tony Award, where they were so happy to see her and said, "You finally did it. It's been 29 years, damn it." You know, and 29 years, she was long overdue, and she earned that Tony Award.
Mm-hmm.
And then some.
One of my favorite Tony Award acceptance speeches I've ever seen, because as she's going, the music is playing to be like, "Hey, wrap it up," and she just, like, being the diva that she is,
she
and I mean
shut that music up, it's been 29 years.
And when I say Broadway diva, like, I don't mean like, "Oh my god, that's a diva." No, I mean like,
she's,
queen,
she's on the Mount
let me
Rushmore
kiss
of
yes
it, yeah.
Let me kiss the ground you walk on, your excellence, like royalty.
For all of you out there, a couple things you should know. First of all, look up Patti LuPone's acceptance speech from the 2008 Tony Awards. You will not regret it. Second of all, go out and read Patti LuPone's autobiography. You will also not regret it. You'll learn about the Andrew Lloyd Webber pool. She is a hilarious human being. She is a hilarious human being. If this pandemic has taught us anything, as we've seen in the videos of Patti LuPone, she's hilarious. Furthermore, she is such a genuinely kind human being. The things that she does backstage for cast and crew members is out of this world. The birthday she remembers, the gifts she gets people. And then me, when I've like met her at another show, the time she took and just how genuinely sweet she was. Patti LuPone is a saint, and I understand why people love her and the performances she gives and the energy she gives. She is a
single performance.
She is a woman that knew what she wanted to do from the word go, and she just gives it her all. And she's just a legend. She earns everything with it. And she plays the tuba. So as things begin to return to normal, and the theater world continues to turn its lights back on, we look forward to returning to see the show again.
You'll be able to catch Gypsy at a theater near you, hopefully this fall. Someone, I'm sensing a Gypsy revival.
Come on now. We also want to encourage all of our listeners out there to continue to help foster the performing arts wherever you are by purchasing tickets to a live event.
Please join us as we continue to raise the curtain on this long overdue second act.
We'd also like to give a quick update. Oh, I'm so excited to get to say this. A quick update on the reopening of Broadway.
Congrats to the company of Passover, now playing at the August Wilson Theater.
Welcome back to the cast of Chicago, now playing at the Ambassador Theater.
Back on Broadway, Hadestown, 8 times a week at the Walter Kerr Theater.
Back at the Richard Rogers Theater, we welcome Hamilton back to Broadway.
Manhattan Theater Company reopens at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater with Lackawanna Blues now playing.
Disney's The Lion King is now entertaining audiences at the Minskoff Theater.
Sarah Bareilles' hit musical Waitress is serving up laughter and joy at the Ethel Barrymore Theater.
Come soar with the cast of Wicked, which is now open at the Gershwin Theater.
Happy official opening to the cast of Six the Musical, now playing at the Brooks Atkins Theater.
Welcome back, David Byron's American Utopia, playing a limited run at the St. James Theater. We are so excited that Broadway is turning its lights back on. Let me say that again. It's worth saying again. We are so excited that Broadway is turning its lights back on and can't wait to share in the magic of the Great White Way.
We will be sharing special episodes when we return to New York City in a few weeks.
And speaking of New York City in a few weeks, make sure you tune in Sunday, September 26th, CBS and Paramount Plus to the Tony Awards. That's right, friends. The Theater High Holy Day back at you. I think it's 6 o'clock. We're going to find out for sure on the next episode on CBS with the Tony Awards hosted by Audra McDonald, followed by a special concert, Broadway Back, hosted by Leslie Odom Jr. on Paramount Plus. And I know it's on two different platforms, two different networks. I get it. I know there's some discrepancy, but guys, the Tony Awards, and Broadway back.
I mean, we're ushering fall in. We're ushering the theater back in. We get a special September
edition of the
Tony Awards.
And Audra McDonald. Speaking of legends.
Audra.
So until next time, I'm Andrew Cortez.
And I'm Hope Bird.
Reminding you to turn off your cell phones.
Unwrap your candies.
And keep talking about the theater.
In a stage whisper.
Thank you.
Two friends from old New York town met in a foreign land. One sang the praises of Cape Perry and
if you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review, like, and subscribe.
You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Stage Whisper Pod.
And feel free to reach out to us with your comments and personal stories at stagewhisperpod@gmail.com.
Our theme song is Fox by Music for Wildlife. Other music on this episode provided by Quantum Jazz, Kevin McLeod, Mela, U.S. Army Blues, and Billy Murray.